Kansas City attorneys Dana Tippin Cutler and Keith Cutler are a married couple, and they co-host a court TV show called Couples Court with the Cutlers, where they combine their legal expertise with their personal experience in love and marriage. The show was just nominated for an Emmy. In this scene, they have some common sense advice for a young man who's been cheating on his wife. He apparently had the audacity to give his girlfriend a ride somewhere while his wife was in the car.
He picked me up. We drove to their house to go get her and her child. I'm in the front seat. She gets in back with her child.
You actually picked up your girlfriend with your wife? Did that happen?
Yes, it did.
I pulled up.
What?
But she didn't want to get out the front seat. I kept telling her, like, she don't want
to tell me to get out. She still had the
car. She was like, no, if she got to fight me to get this front seat.
That's what
she
doesn't matter. Like, what?
He doesn't
okay, you have missed the point.
Okay, that's funny. But not all the shows are.
It has been determined by DNA diagnostics that, Mr. Cleveland, you are not the father.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're going to meet the Cutlers. Dana, Keith, welcome to KCUR Central Standard.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
That just now was quite a moment to be witnessing in someone else's life with cameras rolling.
Right. Right. And that was a really sad show because she already had a child that was not his during their relationship. So now she's had a second child without him during their relationship. It was like, oh my goodness. How much more can you withstand?
Yeah, that guy, I mean, they both break down in tears, but he, you know, really rallies and is like, we'll get through this, you know.
Yeah, and that was kind of his MO in their relationship. She brought some interesting twists to their relationship, and he stood in the gap. He came back again, and, you know, we said he's got a crown in heaven.
Well, so this gets at one of the interesting things about this show. I want to hear the history of the show, but you guys have legal expertise, but this often gets into the territory of informal couples counseling.
True, true. And I think that's why when MGM was thinking of starting this show, they originally were like, well, let's just get a man and a woman and have their viewpoints on it. And Barry Posnick, who's the number two at MGM, he was like, you know what? What we really need is a husband and wife, because we're going to need that dynamic and that level of relationship between these two to help these couples. So I think it was brilliant on his part.
And that's one of the great things about the show. It combines our experience as a couple for 35 years now, along with our legal experience. So that dovetails nicely into what we do as we try to help the couples who appear on Couples Court.
Does it ever happen, though, that you go home after listening to some of these stories and, like, take other people's tension home with you?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I mean, because we're practicing lawyers, we're used to dealing with other people's problems. That's what we do for a living. And that's what lawyers do for a living. And so we try not to internalize that too much and take it out on each other. When we have a stressful day, we can decompress with the other person, but in a constructive method, not necessarily taking it out on the other one.
Well, we are going to get back to that, but this show was nominated for an Emmy, and I want to congratulate you on that, even though I know that you didn't win. But the nomination is a big deal.
It's huge. It's huge. I mean, we've been on air 6 months, first year, and for the Academy to even see us, you know, like, hey, they're out there and they're doing something unique and different in this genre of TV, daytime TV. You know, everybody has said, and we pretty much recognize, this was pretty spectacular.
Yeah, I mean, to be in the same category as Judge Judy, Judge Greg Mathis, Judge Maybelline, People's Court, Divorce Court. I mean, established courtroom television shows, for us to even
with
be in
generations
the same
of viewers those shows have.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
But okay, so this, you know, Dana, you are president of the Missouri Bar Association.
Immediate past president, the best title ever. All the joy of being president without all the work.
That is a position with just a huge amount of standing and clout in the legal world. You're both real lawyers, practicing lawyers. And I just want to acknowledge, you know, court TV is something that some people look down their noses at. And I'm curious about how you walk that line.
Well, one of the things that we considered as we were chosen to do the show was what was going to be the format of the show. We have real people with real cases and real situations. And that's a question we often get. Are the people real? Are they making this up? These are real people. They're vetted for, you know, months and months to make sure their stories are real. So real people, real issues, real situations. And we are bringing our real life experiences to help them with that.
How long have you been doing this?
The show premiered in September of 2017. So, yeah, we've been on the air. We are finishing up the airing of our first season. We've already started taping season two.
So we've been doing this about, let me do it this way. We got the call about 21 months ago and have been involved for that time period, but we've only been taping since last summer.
Whoa, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so do you have a personal mission with this show?
You know, it came to us out of the blue. And so it wasn't until we actually start taping the show, listening to the feedback of the litigants, the feedback of our viewers, that it has built in a mission for us, because people have said to us consistently, we don't know couples that have been together a long time. We have so many litigants say we don't know anybody who's been together, married or otherwise, 5 years. And so it's kind of become our mission to say marriage is fun, long-term relationship. People have said we didn't think being in a long-term relationship was even fun. So we really feel like we want to be the voice of, it can be what you want it to be, what you make it out to be. And so encouraging people to weather the storm, because people tend to want to run. So that's become our mission is, it's a good thing. It's not necessarily bad to be in a long-term relationship. And here's how you can make that happen.
But there is a pretty strong focus on infidelity.
On the show, yes. That's how all the couples who are on the show, there's some element of infidelity that is alleged. Now, the thing is, all the time is not present. This isn't a show where everybody on there is cheating and you're just waiting to find out, you know, how they got caught. This is a show where the allegations, and maybe even as much as 55% of the time, the people actually are not cheating. It just looks that way. But we help the couples resolve that, because that issue of alleged infidelity is keeping them from being able to move their relationship forward and get the best out of their relationship.
Well, I want to get back to that, but let's start by giving our listeners a taste of some of the kinds of things they might hear on the show. I want to play a couple of clips from one of the most viewed episodes on your show's YouTube channel. This episode stars Lil Mo. She is a singer and record producer, among other things, and she's in a show of her own called Love and Hip Hop. It's about women artists who have played supporting roles for men in the hip hop world. And so now they're kind of looking for their own chance in the spotlight. A lot of people know her from that show. Her husband, Carl, has cheated on her, admittedly. The question is, have there been women Lil Mo doesn't know about?
Mr. Dargan, are there women that you've had sexual intercourse with since you've been married that your wife does not know about?
Say it again, I'm sorry.
Mr. Dargan.
I thought it was more to the question, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Hold on. Mr. Shaw, the polygraph came back deceptive. What else can you add to this?
If I can also add something that this gentleman said to me after the polygraph test.
Please do.
He mentioned to me that there was a time when he told his wife that he may have had sex with somebody. Mm-hmm. But he told me there were other instances where she didn't ask, so he didn't tell her.
And what you cannot see happening there, so many cringing faces in the crowd behind both the plaintiff and the defendant while that is happening.
Exactly.
And that's the beauty of the show, because it's totally unscripted. And so you just never know how it's going to unfold. Again, it's not a show where, yes, somebody's cheating. We're just going to find out how they found out and what happens. I mean, the stories unfold literally right before our eyes.
And we've talked about this, but there is, of course, the legal part, but there's also the emotional, like, counselor-esque piece of it. Carl, Lil Mo's husband, who cheated and who's looking pretty bad at this point, ends up sharing his personal issues. Let's listen.
I used to be out here dealing with multiple women at times, you know, 5, 6 women at one time. I was a thot. I had no intentions on getting married. I had no intentions on ever being with one woman.
But we was married.
But I was trying to work on it, and I told her, listen, I was out here. I was used to this. It's not an overnight process. I'm trying the best I can, but I slipped up and got caught up.
Keith and Dana, I mean, as lawyers with a court TV show, how do you help people in moments like that? Because guilty or not is actually not the question.
You know, and this comes down to this part about weathering the storm. That couple in particular was married. And I said, you know, you took vows, you said better for worse. And this is probably as worse as it's going to get in terms of your relationship. And so at that point, how do you extend grace and forgiveness to Little Mo? And then how do you commit to doing better? And what tools do you need to do that? That becomes really part of the conversation for us at that point where someone said, yeah, I've messed up. Then how do you move forward?
I mean, people here are disclosing such personal things. And of all the personal things you could disclose, ones that make you look not good.
Right.
And I wonder, do you feel like it is voyeuristic of us to be riveted by these things? Or is there something really worthwhile in it for them and for us?
I think there is something worthwhile. I mean, when you step back and look, the reason we read books, the reason we go to movies, the reason we watch television are because of things like love, hate, jealousy, greed, those emotions that impact us all and that we've all experienced. So it's not voyeuristic, it's just part of the human experience.
It's universal.
Yeah, it's universal. And a show like Couples Court with the Cutlers, what we do is we take that and we don't exploit the litigants who appear in front of us. We try to help them. We give them techniques to move their relationship forward. We talk to them about how to communicate, how to really hear what the other person is saying, how to be in a committed, faithful relationship. Those are the things that we try to impart.
And we hear from our viewers, you know, all the time, I'm learning from you. I didn't think about that. That's a different way to proceed on this issue. So we, you know, it does become community service in its own way to couples across the country.
Have you ever been just totally stumped?
We have been totally astounded, like sitting there going, oh boy. Yeah, that has happened more than once. Because again, we're sitting there in the moment, just like everybody else, finding out things and things are unfolding in front of us. So absolutely, we've been astounded and we've been stumped.
How did the two of you meet?
We met as freshmen in college. I went to Morehouse College. Danny went to Spelman College, brother and sister colleges in Atlanta, Georgia. And long story short, we met at a rehearsal for a fashion show that Dana was in charge of. I was there with some of my friends who were participating, and we met. She immediately put me to work. And
put him to work how?
As a stagehand. And so we were in a group of friends, and we started out as friends, and one thing led to another, and a relationship blossomed and materialized, and 35 years later, here we are.
Do you have experiences? I mean, it's such a happy love story, 35 years, here you are, you're married. with a court TV show, excelling in your careers, all of that, helping other people with your example. But part of being able to help people has to be having weathered your own storms.
Sure. We've been self-employed. So that means we, you know, when clients pay, it's great. When clients don't pay, it's not so great. We've had 3 sons. They're all adults now. So we've weathered, you know, what children and teenage boys will bring to the family dynamic. You know, my in-laws died early in our marriage. So we've gone through deep grief together. We've never had infidelity, thank goodness. But I think we've had friends who've had those issues, and we've weathered those storms with them and watched how that played out. So, we understand a lot of the pieces that people are dealing with.
You know, you told the New York Times that you saved the drama for the courtroom, and you've kind of alluded to that before, that you don't bring the tensions of the courtroom home with you.
Mm-hmm.
But can you talk a little more about how that works?
Well, I think at our core, we're best friends. And sometimes even best friends get sideways with each other over various issues. But again, I think a lot of lawyers, because we deal with other people's issues and problems and concerns all day long, it can be easy to bring that home, but you have to make a committed effort not to do that. So we talk about work because we work together, we practice together. But in terms of actually bringing the tension home and taking it out on each other, I'd much rather laugh and talk with her than to argue with her. And so keeping that in mind, yeah, I'd much rather go for the laughter.
Well, and my best friend says we are the best compartmentalizer she's ever met. I can put an issue in a box, shut that box, and not deal with it anymore. I didn't realize it was a skill set, but it really is. I mean,
I want a lesson.
I wish I could. I mean, I'm like, okay, I can't do anything about that right now. So I'm not going to just continue to wrestle with it. And I don't know how I do it. And he does it too. We just can put it in a box and put it to the side.
Can you tell me a little bit about the TV staging piece of this? Because there have to be aspects of this that are staged. Like, this is not just how a courtroom works, is it? Do people confuse this with, like, how a courtroom, I mean...
Well, it's not like a real-life courtroom would work, because in a real-life courtroom, there are rules of procedure. There's certain evidentiary rules that you have to follow, like you can't have hearsay testimony, things like that. In our courtroom, on couples court, we don't have to deal with those issues. So from that aspect, the procedure is different than you would find in a real-life courtroom. There is some staging if... You know, one of us has a coughing fit, you know, we can stop and start over again. So it's that aspect from a television standpoint. We get a little snapshot of information about the litigants, who they are, where they're from, what their issue is, whether they're married, whether they have children. But pretty much beyond that, it's unscripted. And that's the beauty of it. We get to play off of each other and just be ourselves.
Well, Keith Cutler, Diana Tippin Cutler, excuse me, Dana Tippin Cutler, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Keith and Dana are the judges on Couples Court with the Cutlers, which was up for an Emmy this year, and they live here in Kansas City. Up next, turning your genealogy into a story on KCUR's Central Standard. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now we're going to dive into genealogy. There are so many tools available now for people who want to know more about their family's lineage, from DNA testing through mail order kits to online access to vital statistics, family records, those kinds of things. But do the details you find come together in a meaningful way that answers the deeper questions that sent you searching to begin with? Our next guests will talk to us about how to make real meaning out of the information you can find. But if you've done DNA testing or genealogy research yourself, we'd love to know whether it changed the story you tell about who you are and who your family is. Has your personal narrative changed? 816-235-235. 2888 is the number to call. Nicole Schlegel is with us from the Midwest Genealogy Center. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, Gina.
So what usually inspires people to begin the process of digging for details about their family's past?
It can be very different things for different people. Sometimes people will come in and say, I have this one story that's always been told. Maybe a grandmother or great-grandmother was Native American, or an ancestor went down on a shipwreck or something like that. So they come in wanting to prove that. Other people come in just saying,
wanting to prove it, not find out if it's true or
disprove
it.
Yeah. So find out if it's true or not true.
Yeah.
And you have to do that sort of thing. Or they want to come in and just say, I want to start with me and go back as much as I can to find out what I can. So it really just kind of depends on each person that comes in.
When people in that second scenario, is it something, do you get a sense of what has inspired that curiosity, if not a specific story? Just is there something that people feel is lacking when they don't have that information?
I think what it does is it kind of helps them know where they come from in a way. So, I mean, maybe a little bit lacking. They don't necessarily come out and say that when they first, you know, walk into our library. But as they go through, they find things like they had ancestors came from Ireland or Germany or wherever it might be. And then kind of that can connect into larger historical things that happened there. And, you know, just kind of make it all more a worldview than just with themselves.
But I would imagine that the kinds of details people can get through this process are often going to leave them with just follow-up questions.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And that's what we're here for, because sometimes people will have done that, some of that, and come in and say, okay, I found this record or I found this document. What do I do now? Where can I go now? And that's what all of us at the Midwest Genealogy Center are there to help them do, is find those next steps. Where's more resources you can look for to find that next step?
So I have done some writing about people that I've never met, historical figures, and not ones with tons and tons of information out there about them. Like in one case, it was a woman who had escaped slavery, and I knew who had, quote, owned her, mm-hmm. you know, and when she had left and where she had ended up in a couple of cases. And that's pretty much it, with also some letters, a couple of letters sent after she was safely in Chicago.
Okay.
But what was interesting was the process of trying to take people through her story in a way that made it compelling, where you know that this dramatic thing had happened in her life, but you don't have her there telling you, you know, I was crouched in the bushes over here, mm-hmm. you know, I ended up doing things like looking at the Farmer's Almanac to find out what the weather would have been like when she was in hiding in different places and things like that to kind of get some details. But I would imagine that people doing genealogy and trying to put ancestors' stories into really vivid terms struggle with the same thing.
Oh, sure. And it's nice because we that's why what we have at our library is not only things like, you know, vital record information, but we have other resources like you were mentioning, so you can kind of get an idea of about maybe it's a narrative from somebody else who went through something similar, and so they can read that and be like, my ancestor possibly, I mean, this is a possible thing that could have had the same event that happened with my ancestor in a similar situation. And that's a good way to just kind of help, you know, round out that person's life, even if you don't find that one document that says, you know, my ancestor Mary Smith had that same exact experience happen to her.
Has DNA testing, or just the popularity of services, you know, like 23andMe, has that changed what you see and how you do your work?
Not really. What is it? Just it's another tool that genealogists or people interested in family history can use, because it can either be you find something that you didn't know and it gives you a whole new research avenue, or it can help prove that your research you've done so far is correct and you're on the right track and you're not following the wrong person who might have a similar name.
But I imagine that too kind of leaves people often with a lot of unanswered questions. Yes. And still not really knowing how to tell their family's stories.
Yes. And so we have resources here to be able to help, you know, show how that can, you can use DNA as like to integrate DNA in with the rest of your research that you're doing to just add another depth to that story that you're telling about your family.
So this is where the Midwest Genealogy Center's new collaboration with the Woodneath Library's Center for the Story enters the picture.
Yes.
Dave Burns is the press manager from the Story Center there. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning.
So you have been working as part of this collaboration to help people turn their own genealogy, the information they can dig up, into stories.
Absolutely, yeah. We began discussing this probably about a year or so back, and it was just such an obvious pairing in my mind. that we have the opportunity at the Story Center to help people tell their stories, and we have the Midwest Genealogy Center helping people find their ancestors and do this research. And so many times I've found, as I talk with people doing genealogy, is they don't know what the story is. They have so much information, and they have so many really great pieces, but getting to the story can be difficult. And so what we collaborated on was this idea of what MGC is doing is amazing, helping people get these resources together. And so we can come in and help them kind of structure that in a story format, give them the pieces of what makes a good story so that they can relay these to their ancestors, to their children, to whoever needs to, they would like to share the story with.
Does having this information in story form, does that matter to the people themselves? I mean, there's obviously this idea of an audience being future generations possibly, but does it also help shape the meaning for the people doing the research?
Absolutely, because they're getting all these pieces together. And I've had people show me, like, look at all these amazing things that have happened. What do I do with this? How do I craft this into something that is meaningful for myself?
Can you give me an example of that?
Sure. Working with some folks, people have, like this last class we did, we had several people bring ideas of what they've been researching. And so one being an individual was writing about her grandfather, who was a sheriff in a small town, and had heard a story about how he tracked down a jewelry thief, which I thought was an amazing story. But as we started to dissect it and started to put the pieces together of what makes a story, like we're talking about character and setting, theme, plot, all these pieces that go into a good story, she was actually able to craft something that the entire class really dove into and embraced, because all of a sudden it wasn't just her story about her grandfather. It was this amazing story that everyone could relate to because it had a human element. And I think that's the aspect as we go through, we talk with genealogy and story, there's this idea of human element. Something that makes a good story is something that everyone can relate to and connect with. The example I give often is, you know, The Wizard of Oz, we're all familiar with the story, but it's a story of going home. Ultimately, it's a story of Dorothy trying to find her way home. And I think that is one of those human pieces.
But, okay, so how do you get the human piece when what you have are marriage certificates, death certificates, things like that? Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you, without fictionalizing, do it?
Right. Well, I think what's, as Nicole mentioned, there's a lot of resources at MGC to kind of put the whole piece, the whole story together. And so you can take these elements and start to see what these people, what they lived, what their lives were like. You know, for example, if you have a story of tragedy, if you have an ancestor who maybe came to America because they were escaping tragedy and had difficulty because they were an immigrant or whatever the case may be, you begin to see this common theme that people now can relate to. This idea that even though I may not have lived there, I can relate to this idea that life is not always, life can be difficult and there are things to overcome. In other more humorous stories, you might be able to see the just the humor in life, or sometimes the absurdity of things that happen. So as I know, Nicole, as I know you've seen as you go through research, sometimes life just happens to folks and situations pop up, and so often it depends on how the individual relates to it and how they respond to it. One particular example, I was meeting with an individual who was telling the story of just constant tragedy from their ancestor. And the human element, not only was this difficult path they went through, but the fact that their child survived and actually became pretty fairly successful in their life despite all these things that happened.
Can you tell us a little bit more specifically what this tragedy was?
They're fleeing other country to come here, death of a child at a young age, difficulties with substance abuse and those sort of things, just kind of constantly popping up throughout life.
Let's talk to Dan in Overland Park about his experience with genealogy and what it's meant to him at 816-235-2888. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. How about you?
Okay. When I'd called in, we have found lots of stories in working on the genealogy. In the early 90s, when my grandmother passed, we found a shoebox, two shoeboxes filled with funeral cards, you know, little prayer cards that Catholics have at funeral. for those that don't know about funeral cards, Catholics have them. They're usually the name of the person who's deceased, their date of birth, and then the day they died. The older ones have actually sometimes what they did for a living in a photo. And so I had found a shoebox with over 400 of these that dated back to the 1800s, and they'd been passed down to my grandmother. And that's what I used to get started on my genealogy. And then heard stories from the rest of the family and began to work on a story of when my third great-grandfather came to America. He had two small boys, and the story was that he was a stowaway or that he was a hired hand of another gentleman that came over. As I researched it further, I found out that there was no stowaway, that the hired hand was actually his nephew that he brought, who was 21, old enough to help him on the farm.
Dan,
got back here.
Is there a part of you that would like that previous stowaway story to be true?
Yes, yes, of course there was. But as you were mentioning in other stories, depending on which side of the family, the story was told as who the hired hand was and who the other one wasn't.
Huh.
So, and finding out that it was an actual relative, then they all agreed on the real story after we found, you know, paperwork that proved it.
So there's been some unity around knowing the truth.
Yes. And the sad part is after the ancestor came over here, he was only here 4 years when he passed away. And his wife wound up marrying the nephew.
Whoa. So it sounds like there might be some historic need for unity also.
That's right. That's right.
But Dan, so, I want to get back to these prayer cards because that is, you know, many human lives lived, people who are your relatives, many of whom I'm guessing you never got to meet, don't know much about.
Yes.
And you have their names, often their photos, maybe a couple of details. Does that leave you feeling more connected or just more aware of how little you know and how much you want to know?
It's really made me more connected. And in the time, you know, in the 20 years that I've had these cards, I've done a lot of research. And through Facebook and things, other people have found out I had them. And, you know, I'm known as the Himmelberg with the cards. And so I will get strangers that are part of the family want to know about certain things. And it's really allowed me to interact with people all over the country that are part of the family.
So, Dan, is there a character in this collection of prayer cards who you've been able, whose story you really feel like you have been able to tell?
Well, yes. And it's my third great grandfather who came over from Germany in the 1847 and learned a lot about him and be able to find out a lot of research that, you know, kind of tells all of us how we got started here in America.
Wow. Well, that is amazing, Dan. Congratulations. And we are going to get right back to this conversation in just a minute with your stories about finding meaning in your own genealogy that you can pass along to a future generation. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I'm sitting here with Dave Burns of the Woodneath Library and Nicole Schlegel from the Midwest Genealogy Center. They've been helping people turn genealogical details into stories that they can pass along, stories with real meanings about the characters themselves and sometimes stories that might change how entire families think about themselves. Welcome back to the show, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, you know, we were talking about like the kinds of stories that send people digging. There's a detail from my family's history that it's always been a source of mystery because, when my dad was a kid, his brother ran away. And I think it was too painful for him to really explore the wide range of possibilities of what might have happened to this person. But of course, in a little kid's mind, the uncle who ran away, like anyone out there could be my uncle, which was kind of an amazing source of imagination and all of that. But I had often wondered, you know, I don't know, it seemed almost mythological and there was all this, so many questions surrounding it and never any real evidence, just a couple of times this was mentioned and that's it. But on those online, I can't even think like myancestry.com, those kinds of things, something turned up. One of my relatives saw it, a census thing where it said the names of the people in the household. And so now I know the name of this brother of my dad's. He was, yeah, definitely a real person. And knowing that he had a name, that is such a trivial detail, but it changed things for me. He was suddenly a real guy.
Oh,
you know?
Sure, yeah.
He's not just anyone.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, being able to find things using census records, as you said, or even a newspaper article can really help, you know, either start the journey if you were wanting to go try to find that person, or give that sense of like, okay, this is a real thing that happened and it wasn't just sort of a family myth that was told type of thing, because it's there's a basis for it. There's the name for it.
When it comes to story, I mean, Dave, as you help people tell stories, are you also walking people through things that have carried a lot of emotion through their families for generations? Like, if I were to write a story about this, it's not really my emotion, it was my dad's, but still, you know, that would be digging into some really, really charged territory.
Yes, I've worked with a lot of individuals who are writing those very similar stories. They're coming in and writing a memoir about their father or grandfather. And even though there might be a generation or two removed, it can be very cathartic for folks. There's a lot of emotion that goes through those because there's a reason people are telling their story. There's a reason people are digging through their ancestry because they're trying to find out who they are.
And they're digging because they're digging in the specific areas where they don't already have information. And Sometimes there's a reason for that.
Yes. A lot of times things are hidden in families. As I'm sure we've all experienced, you might start digging through your family and there might be those myths, as you've mentioned, that we're never quite sure where the truth lies. And a lot of times it's because there's something that's painfully happened. It might be a death or a tragedy or something like that.
So how do you walk people through that experience?
Well, from my perspective, I walk them through, try to help them find the facts in the story, because for many of these individuals, they're wanting, again, just the facts of what happened. And so helping them identify what those specific facts are, who the characters are, what's happening, kind of what's the purpose of the story. For when I work with genealogists, that's one of the big questions is what is the, I'll use a story word, theme. What's the theme? And so for another story, theme might be this idea of good versus evil or what have you. But for genealogy, it's why am I trying to tell the story? Am I telling it for myself? Am I telling it for my family? And so when I'm working with those individuals who are, they're telling it for themselves, you start to get those real emotional aspects of my father was an amazing man. He went through all these sort of things. And it can be, as I mentioned, it can be a little bit cathartic for them as they're working through that.
But then do you caution them that, I mean, because I would think part of that question is, at what point is sharing this story a service to your family? And at what point are you just opening a can of worms that can be really hurtful?
Yes. I've talked with a few different individuals on that situation of, you know, as they've shared these stories and say, this is, you know, we ran across this and this is a really fascinating story. And I've even had them say, but this might cause some issues with other family members. And, you know, so my response is always, we want to help people be tell a story that's going to have a positive impact. And if they have a concern that this might be problematic, it may not be the right time to tell that story. Maybe it's just for them in the moment.
You know, Nicole, do you ever caution people against finding the truth in some situations?
Well, I wouldn't say we use the word caution, but we do, you know, when we do classes at the Midwest Genealogy Center where we talk about, you know, getting started with genealogy or researching different types of, you know, using different types of resources. And we say, you know, there may be things that you find that you weren't expecting to find. And, you know, we've had people like Dave just mentioned who will come in and find something and say, oh, you know what, I can maybe tell this cousin or my sister, but it won't go beyond that, you know. But, you know, maybe somebody comes and asks me, I'll tell them. But they're like, I'm not going to bring that to the family reunion and share that with everybody because that story might, you know, upset more people than that. So, you know, and the thing is that, you know, family skeletons, you know, that's what part of what you find doing genealogy. So most people, I think, you know where what story to share and when not to do it. Or maybe just, as Dave said, to do it for themselves or a few people in their family.
Dave, you were saying that you want to help people do this for good, like for positivity and for, I don't know. I mean, it sounds like something that can change a family's sense of self. And can you give an example of when that's happened in a positive way?
Yeah. I was meeting with one individual who was, again, I think we mentioned this a little bit earlier, was talking about her grandfather was a sheriff in a small town and who was just beloved by this town. And come to find out, as she was digging through the research, there was a situation where the newspaper recorded one story, and when she actually sat down and interviewed her grandfather, she heard a completely different story, a different twist on that. And for her, it just cemented the fact that he was a humble, well-respected individual. And for them, it became part of their families. We are people that are humble and that are going to be honest and truthful and not necessarily, you know, he didn't go after the newspaper and try to correct the story. He just accepted and moved forward. So for them, that became part of their heritage.
Like the disconnect and how he handled that.
Yes, yes.
You know, there's a book I read. It was something like The Secrets of Happy Families or something. And, mm-hmm. it was about how the stories we tell ourselves as families shape people's level of like confidence and self-esteem mm-hmm. and things like that. And one of the things was that stories that go straight in a positive direction, those are dangerous because it's a lot to live up to. Mm-hmm. Or stories that just are going on this downhill trajectory make people think like, oh, everything's falling apart in our family. The glory days are over. But the perfect story is apparently the one that is kind of neither of those things, that has storms that have been weathered and, you know, good times that we can still feel.
That is just kind of the basic of the idea of story in general, is there needs to be, you know, we go back to this theory of story, there needs to be something that happened that moves the story along. There has to be a climactic moment. And so if I tell you a great story about how everything has always been just beautiful and perfect, that's a great anecdote, but it's not necessarily a story.
Well, we have a tiny bit of time, and I want to talk to, I believe it is Ara in Lawrence.
Yeah.
We have just like a minute or so, so I know that's not much time, but please share your story.
Oh, well, I'm an American historian, so I decided to do my own genealogy. And I was telling, one of the strangest things that came about for me is, of course, American historian, we learn about the, you know, our black eye in the history of being slave owners. And I found out that my family was.
Oh, my gosh.
And I found out through wills that they left actually persons to their children. And I only found this out when I went back east to Virginia to work there in Congress for a while. And people begin to recognize my family's last name. And they said, oh, don't you know? Serve the House of Burgesses. They were one of the biggest like slave-owning plantation families. And I didn't know. And here I am, a Midwestern girl, you know, where my family had come out here by homestead after the Civil War. And I was shocked. I was stunned.
Have you been able to reconcile that information?
Well, you know how I did it was that I had found friends of mine that I'd worked with in Virginia that had came from those same families, and I found African-American persons who carried my family's last name.
What did you do with that?
I had to kind of have a conversation with them because I said, I know it's not my generation, but I feel in some way like I'm responsible. Even though I'm, you know what I'm saying, like, even though it's not my generation, I'm like, wow, my great-great-grandparents, they wrote laws for them.
Yeah.
They not only just abided by it, but, you know, and they were a very well-to-do, very wealthy family. They married into the Washington family.
Yeah.
They just had a lot of, and I just didn't know really what to say to them. So I think the best bit is we had an open dialogue.
Yeah. I have to say goodbye to you. I'm so sorry, but that is a fascinating story. Thank you for telling it. And, you know, it is time to say goodbye, but that's just an example of the relevance of some of these stories. And we have to leave it there. But Dave Burns, Nicole Schlegel, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Midwest Genealogy Center and the Woodneath Library are still holding more of those sessions on turning relatives' stories from the past into stories that translate down the road. So keep an eye out for those events on the calendars if you're interested. And now, sometimes it's actually distance from your family that you need to let your own story emerge, and that might be true for this next artist. Singer-songwriter Una Walkenhorst is the daughter of Bob Walkenhorst from The Rainmakers. That's a Kansas City band that was big nationally and internationally in the 1980s. That was before Una was even born. When she was 21, she decided to leave town so she could prove herself as a musician. For our Story of a Song series, we talked with Una about a song called Man Like a City.
Smoking on Pier 45, I feel more alive than you ever made me.
I knew that if I started my music career here, I would have a lot of opportunities, but not all of them would be because of my music. They would be because I was someone's daughter, which, you know, I'm very appreciative of those opportunities, but I really wanted to start out knowing that any credit that I was given was because I was a good musician. So I decided to get in my two-door Honda Civic and drive across the country for a year and a half and just play wherever would have me, whether that was people's houses or open mics. Then after I had done it a little bit, I started actually booking real gigs.
Oh, but there's no man, no man like the city, no man like the city. Well, I could write for days about all of the ways, but all
I have to usually be all by myself to write a song, and I was so inspired after going to this open mic in Greenwich Village that I was able to just sit on the pier and write while surrounded by all these other people, which was really special for me.
Just to be a part, just to leave my mark, a memory to deliver.
There's a part where I talk about I don't have anything to write on but these business cards, and I wrote this whole song on the back of like 10 business cards.
But all I have to mark on are these business cards and 2x3.5 just ain't enough to describe.
This was really the most I had been by myself, driving in my car across the country, just traveling by myself. And so I wrote this song about really learning to be alone and learning to be happy by yourself and finding happiness in these little moments where you're just alone and embracing everything by yourself.
There's no love like the river, no love like the river. The Hudson, she carries me. Let her marry me.
I got out of the longest relationship I had been in. And so I'm kind of learning to be by myself again, you know. After you're in a long relationship, you kind of have to relearn how to be alone. I have quite a few songs that I wrote when I was on the road about, you know, learning to be alone. And so those kind of have new significance now to me.
I know I will sleep on my own. Now it ain't so hard.
You know, there's no man like the city. You can have all these experiences in a city by yourself. And there's no love like the river, just kind of witnessing nature and these special things by yourself.
Alone, there's no one to impress. I don't have to undress to prove that I'm here and I'm moving, that my facts are proven. I don't need your okay.
Specifically in this age of Instagram and Facebook where we kind of have to post things for them to be real, it's like you don't have to do that all the time. You can witness these things by yourself and still find the magic when you're alone.
That was Una Walkenhorst talking about the song Man Like a City. Una recorded this song for NPR's Tiny Desk Contest. And she'll be performing as part of KCUR's Tiny Desk Contest Showcase. Join us for that event at the Beer Station this Saturday. You can also catch some other local bands, Secondhand King, Blue False Indigo, and Soul Revival. You can get more details at kcur.org/tinydesk. Again, that's this Saturday at the Beer Station in Waldo. And Una's story, which we just heard, was produced by KCUR's Anna Yakutenko. That's all for Central Standard this morning, but if you missed parts of the show or want to share it with a friend, we'll have a link ready at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's where we archive all our shows, kcur.org/centralstandard. And you can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We are at KCURCST. Tomorrow, we're talking all about Janelle Monáe, the Kansas City, Kansas native who just keeps blowing people's minds. With her performance style, her bold persona, her take on gender, gender. She recently came out of the closet as pansexual in a recent Rolling Stone article, so we will have the Janelle Monáe story tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.